This program may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Good morning. Today, my guests are Jason Workmaster and Jack Horan. They are partners at the law firm of McKenna, Long & Aldridge, LLP, here in Washington, D.C. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Roger.
Yeah, and well, first, guys, today we're going to talk about the Civil False Claims Act and what it means to government contractors and recent developments in that area. But just as a preface, tell me a little bit about your practice areas. You guys specialize in this, is that correct?
Yes, Roger. This is Jason. I've been practicing this area for a good while, representing scheduled contractors and various other contractors who find themselves on the wrong end of a Civil False Claims Act case, and also represent clients in bid protests and other kinds of matters that come up in government contracting.
And Roger, I'm in the government contracts department of McKenna, Long & Aldridge as well. I do the broad range of government contracts practice, but I tend to focus on False Claims Act cases. In a prior life, I was a prosecutor with the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office, so I've gained a particular interest in fraud cases and even criminal cases.
Okay, so you've been on the other side.
I have been on the other side.
Okay, well, guys, well, let's dive right into the subject. Civil False Claims Act, can we just, for the listeners, give us a context of what we're talking about here and why it's important to government contractors?
Sure. The Civil False Claims Act, simply stated, is the kind of the civil fraud statute that the government can use to bring lawsuits against contractors or anyone that is allegedly has submitted a false claim to the government, and that claim has to be a request for money. Request for money to the government that somehow was allegedly improper. And the interesting thing about this Civil False Claims Act as well is that it does not have to be an action that is brought by the government itself. A whistleblower or a key TAM relator, that's the technical term, can bring one of these cases, that's a private person, in the name of the government, and then the government can decide whether it wants to intervene and take the case over, or if it chooses not to, the case can still go forward with the whistleblower prosecuting the case on behalf of the government. And in those cases, the whistleblower actually, of course, stands to recover a certain portion of the proceeds, if there are any, either in a settlement or in a verdict.
And when you say, Jack, when Jason says request for money, what in a government contracts context, what are we really talking about here? Invoices?
Yeah, unfortunately for the contractors, courts have interpreted the request for money pretty broadly, and it can mean essentially any invoice sent to the government for payment. And the False Claims Act, Civil False Claims Act cases get the attention of the contractor for all the reasons Jason said. But also because it is a fraud statute, and contractors get very concerned about allegations of fraud. And in addition, it has very serious penalties. The False Claims Act provides for treble damages, three times the amount of the damage that the government may have suffered, plus a penalty of up to $11,000 per false claim. And as you pointed out, because the claim could be an invoice, that penalty amount could be very, very significant, particularly for GSA contractors who oftentimes accept orders many times during a day and put in invoices for those orders to the government agency many times during a day.
And one other thing just to follow up on that, the other thing that's important to keep in mind in considering this statute is, as we continue to talk about it, it's a fraud statute. And so what folks oftentimes will think is, I submitted my invoice and I somehow meant to deceive the government in my invoice. And what's the other thing that's troubling for contractors often is that's not the way the statute works. The statute actually only requires that the contractor submitting the invoice act with reckless disregard for the truth or deliberately deliberate ignorance of the truth of the statements that it's making to the government. And so that can be kind of a mushy standard, and it's not what just kind of you're thinking of a fraud. You know, normally thinking of fraud, you think of, hey, I meant to lie. But that's not what the government or a relator has to show in this kind of case.
Yeah, and do most of these cases come up? Are they those, you know, you guys, the, yeah, I know I'm an attorney too, but you know, I'll leave you guys are the experts. So, hey, so relators, is that how, you know, the private citizen or a whistleblower, is that how most of these cases come up? Or, you know, is it government audits? What typically happens?
I think if you're going by pure number, it's probably most of the cases come up from the relator, the private attorney general. And there's a good reason for that. There's quite an incentive for someone to file a False Claims Act case, and that is, as you know, Roger, they get a portion of the recovery of the damages, and that portion ranges. But in significant cases, could be quite a lot of money. So I would say by numbers, the overwhelming numbers are probably QI-TAM relators filing the case. But DOJ does file its own False Claims Act case after an investigation that could start with an audit or a hotline call or just about any other way an investigation starts.
And so to keep on this subject in terms of the relator versus Department of Justice, now, my impression one of the key sort of, tipping points in a case often is whether or not, like, let's say a private relator has filed, you know, a Civil False Claims Act suit, and DOJ takes a look at it. They have to make a decision whether they're essentially going to intervene in the case or not. And you get a sense there. That sort of, to me, that always struck me as a tipping point in terms of, you know, whether, you know, you've got somebody on a wild goose, you know, some private citizen on a wild goose chase versus some, you know, something that may perhaps be more substantial.
Yeah, the cases that tend to get litigated further are the ones in which the government intervenes, you know, because the government brings the resources of the Justice Department to litigate those cases. So those cases tend to go further. I think that cases that are the government doesn't intervene tend to get dismissed or resolved earlier on in the process. But in terms of the substance of the cases, Roger, I don't know what Jack would say about this, but you know, in terms of the substance, I have a difficult time sometimes. I kind of scratch my head. Because some of the cases the Justice Department brings seem just about the same type of allegations, the same amount of substance as the one the relators brings. But it's, you know, I do think courts also tend to view cases that in which the government intervenes, they tend to view them a little bit differently. And the government does get a little bit more, I don't want to say benefit of the doubt, but that's probably the best term I can use in pursuing these cases, because it does have that imprimatur of the Justice Department.
Yeah,
and I think your general impression that intervention is a tipping point is still true, but I think it was probably more true about 5 or 10 years ago, because with the great increase in my experience of QI-TAM cases and the difficulty in the Department of Justice to completely review and investigate all the filed cases, many more of these cases are continuing forward even without government intervention, because the relator has a law firm that is willing to continue with them.
Right.
So it used to be that the lack of intervention was pretty much a guarantee that the case would go away, but more recently that's less true. And the Department of Justice has had a policy for quite some time that the failure to intervene doesn't mean that they're not going to permit the case to go forward. There's a general misconception out there, I think, that if DOJ looks at it and then decides not to intervene, that they've determined there's no merit in the case and the case isn't going forward. All that means is that DOJ isn't going to actively participate in the case. They oftentimes or always still monitor the case and will participate again at the time of settlement or in other key points in the case if they think it's necessary.
Okay, well, now let's get down to some of the details. How, you know, in the context of this statute, you know, and the oversight and enforcement of it, how, you know, we talk about certifications, you know, and the submission of invoices. Just, can you walk me through that in terms of what does it mean to, you know, submit, you know, a false invoice, you know, invoice that somebody could rely on for Civil False Claims Act?
Sure. And where this has come up recently in some litigation, and you'll hear these terms out there, is an implied certification theory of False Claims Act liability. But what, at the heart of the matter is there a false claim? That's really the question that has to be decided. And then the question is, well, how do I show that this invoice is false? This came up in a recent case involving the contractor's compliance with organizational conflict of interest regulations, which contractors know those are very complicated. Deciding whether I have an organizational conflict of interest or not can be very difficult to determine.
That's an area that is truly driven by facts and shades of gray, quite frankly.
Very much so. And in this particular case, the contractor was performing. There was an OCI, organizational conflict of interest, OCI clause in their contract.
Okay, well, right there, we're going to have to take a break. Jason, we can start with the OCI clause when we get back. Today, I'm talking to Jason Workmaster and Jack Horan, partners at McKenna Long, and we're talking about the Civil Vaults Claims Act and what it means to government contractors. This is Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Almost 70 years ago, a well-known Connecticut native named Homer Cummings had a dream to start a Washington law firm devoted to working at the intersection of America's business and government. As Attorney General for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he was an integral part of the New Deal. In 1956, Gilbert A. Cuneo joined Cummings' firm to begin what was quickly to become the largest and most successful government contract practice in the country, earning him the title, the Godfather of Government Contracts. That same firm, McKenna, Long & Aldridge, today is recognized by Chambers USA as a Tier 1 government contract law firm, continuing its preeminence in the field through its offices in Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, Denver, and San Diego. With the oldest and largest government contracts practice in the United States, McKenna, Long & Aldridge still operates at the intersection of business and government. They produce solutions by working with their clients on creative and flexible strategies that ensure success. Their attorneys and professionals include former members of government, Congress, and its committees, so they know how Congress thinks and they understand how Washington works. There is no aspect of government contracts with which they are not familiar. In this uncertain economic climate, clients trust them to deliver solutions at costs that represent real value. From one new deal to another, they have remained at the forefront of government contracting. McKenna, Long & Aldridge, a name you can trust.
If you're like most people, you have many financial questions, like, can I afford to retire? How do I protect my nest egg? Will I outlive my money? Hi, I'm Mark Tabron. We'll tackle these questions and more every Saturday morning at 10:30. Learn how to protect and grow your money with me, Mark Tabron, on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Can't wait until Saturday? Call Tabron & Associates Financial Services at 301-773-3923.
The Pentagon and Beyond, brought to you by Airink.
Changes at the top at the Pentagon and the CIA. It's difficult to tell who will do what, but House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers knows what he wants as far as CIA Director Leon Panetta is concerned.
I hope he stays there. I think he wants to stay there. I'm encouraging him to stay there.
And he has some advice for the president.
You may need to find another Secretary of Defense. I think Secretary Gates deserves his time, but I would not make wholesale changes in all of the national security posts all at one time.
I'm J.J. Green.
Solar activity, which causes geomagnetic storms in space, can impact everything from over-the-horizon radar, often used for aircraft and missile launches from a long distance away, to submarine detection systems, to two things we've come to rely on, our cell phones and GPS. Airink has developed a space environmental impact tool that advises, before it happens, what will be affected by bad weather in space. For more information and career opportunities, log on to ARINC.com.
As gas prices rise, more focus will shift toward the administration's ambitious clean energy goals. Join FCA Bethesda and FCA Energy on May 4th at the Bethesda North Marriott for the second Energy and the Environment IT Day, featuring EPA, DOE, GSA, NRC, NOAA, and Interior, to discuss energy efficiency, agency cooperation, and IT spending priorities. Register at FCABethesda.com/EEITDay. Special thanks to premier sponsors Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and Booz Allen Hamilton, and platinum sponsors HP and Centurion Research Solutions.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Jason Workmaster and Jack Horan from McKenna Long & Aldridge, and we're talking about the Civil False Claims Act and what it means to government contractors. And when we took the break, Jason, you were just telling us about an OCI clause in a contract and how it relates to implied certification.
Sure. And again, this was a recent case where the contractor had this OCI clause, and the government wanted to hear about OCIs before they awarded the contract, and then during the contract they wanted to hear about if any OCIs arose. And during performance, the contractor had, before award, it said, we don't have any OCIs, and then didn't tell the government about any during performance, and went ahead and performed, submitted invoices to the government. The invoices themselves said not one word about OCIs. There was no box of, here's our invoice, and we still don't have any OCIs. There was nothing like that. It was just the invoice with an amount. And the government came along, years into performance, and said, no, well, lo and behold, we do think you have an OCI. And not only do we think you have an OCI, but we think you knew you had an OCI, or at least you had reckless disregard for whether you had one. And therefore, all your invoices were false claims within the meaning of the False Claims Act, because you were impliedly certifying simply by submitting your invoice that you were in compliance with this material provision of your contract, which was this OCI provision. And this case went to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and the D.C. Circuit found that the government had articulated a proper implied certification theory of False Claims Act liability. And so from that perspective, the case is kind of a scary one for contractors, because the court even went so far that the contractor had argued, well, look, this is a very complex area of the law. We had a reasonable interpretation. Come on. We had a system where we tracked all of our business interests and we'd bounce them off each other. And the appellate court said, well, yeah, you put on that testimony, but there's also testimony that your system didn't catch all of them and you missed some key words. And yeah, the jury could have found you acted with reckless disregard. So that part of the decision is a little bit scary for contractors, because you do start to think, even if I have a system in place, my system isn't going to save me.
Well, Jack, just play that out a little bit. It seems to me, let's talk about one of our favorite subject, the price reduction clause. I don't think, that clause literally, I don't know how in terms of creating a system, be able to track all the potential price reductions and then track that against your category customer or those type of changes. Given, the court's approach in the case Jason talked about, it seems like quite an issue quite a challenge for a schedule contractor to try to make sure they comply.
It is. I mean, it creates tremendous difficulties, at least in the price reduction clause, Roger, which I agree is very, very difficult for contractors. The noncompliance is arguably related to the, or could be related to the cost of the services or goods. The implied certification cases scare me and have always scared me, because you typically think of a False Claims Act case as being an overcharge of some sort. But the implied certification cases moves the False Claims Act cases out of pricing in some occasions. Here, the pricing was fine. The manner in which the services were performed were fine in the traditional sense. But you have an argument by DOJ or the relator that another type of contract noncompliance creates a false claim, and that's why implied certifications are scary. As the False Claims Act has been in effect, there's been a journey away from pricing noncompliance to other noncompliance with the contract, that just because an invoice or a claim is eventually submitted, contractors have been proceeded against by DOJ under the False Claims Act case.
Yeah, and let me, is a real life example is when you think the Trade Agreements Act compliance? I mean, you theoretically, if you, that requirement in your contract that you only provide products from a designated end country or from the United States, somebody provides something, mistakenly or whatever. From China, they haven't complied with their contract, but the government might have been actually charged a lower price.
Right.
When you're talking about the harm to the government.
Right. No, and that's one of the first examples, I think, of the application of the False Claims Act to the non-traditional areas. And as you pointed out, Trade Agreements Act requires.
I will say, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I will say, the government, the response would be, well, that's an important policy in terms of, trade and all that sort of stuff. So it's there for a reason, and you got to comply with it. I mean,
but that is what they'd say. But I think if the government would be candid on the Trade Agreements Act, they would also acknowledge that for years and years, despite the statute and the clauses, that no one really paid attention to it. And it wasn't until a Key Tamry later brought a case. I think it was the first set of cases were on the office supply schedule that anyone really focused on that type of compliance. Not as an excuse, but for the reasons that you said, it doesn't directly relate to the prices being charged under the schedule contract. And one might argue that the government is getting the benefit of lower priced products. And for the most part, I think if the government was candid, many of the purchasers aren't really particularly concerned about the sourcing of the products. But you're right. It's a contract clause. It requires compliance. And DOJ has made it clear through a number of cases that now that is going to be the basis for their for False Claims Act cases that they will bring.
Yeah. And on this issue of what we've all been talking about here is kind of the question of materiality. You know, the question of, you know, what clause is at issue? You know, is it an OCI clause? Is it your Trade Agreements Act clause? You know, what's the clause? And on that issue, you know, one of the things that the DC Circuit was sensitive to was, well, we've adopted this very broad implied certification theory. Don't trust us. It's not going to be too scary because we're going to rigorously monitor materiality and we're going to rigorously monitor scienter, which is the intent requirement, you know, that you have to have acted with at least reckless disregard. But on materiality, what the court had to say was simply, well, a material provision is one that is not minor. It's one that is one that's not ancillary. And so you kind of do, you still scratch your head. Well, what are the material ones and what are the minor ones? And what contracting officer, if this thing ever, you know, push ever comes to shove, is going to say, well, the clause at issue here, well, it was just a minor one. I never cared about it. So that's what's, you know, is again, even though the court, you know, is saying it's sensitive to that, and we would trust that that's exactly what the courts will do, it's kind of avoiding the question of, you know, the way these things actually play out is once you get into litigation, the government folks, it's very unlikely they're going to say a clause is not important.
And it is very difficult to predict. I mean, I think if you were to poll practitioners in the area before that case as to the likelihood that a False Claims Act case would be based on an OCI representation, most would say that's an area that we haven't heard about and we're not expecting. And as you know, Roger, the
Maybe I don't.
Yeah, no, I bet you know this one. I bet you know this one. The GSA solicitation has tons of clauses in there, and to a certain extent, you're wondering which of the clauses, next clause in there, a failure to comply with, could be the basis for a False Claims Act case.
Yeah, I will say, yes, there are tons of clauses in the solicitation, or a fair number. Yeah, and speaking of clauses, and this is related, but I just popped in my head. I want to ask you guys, and that is, you know, how does the mandatory disclosure clause, how does it play in this dynamic, with regard to the Civil False Claims Act, where, you know, now, you know, there's a FAR clause, Federal Acquisition Regulation clause, that requires contractors to actually disclose, you know, potential violations, or, you know, or where there's credible evidence of a violation of the Civil False Claims Act.
It adds to the complexity because you're now, as I just said, you're trying to predict what contract noncompliance could possibly be a False Claims Act case. And now you have a mandatory disclosure obligation based on that prediction. It's, I guess, easier in the area, the traditional areas of False Claims Act case where, you know, if a client overprices something,
right,
it's,
yeah,
it's that. But if you were counseling the contractor in the OCI case before that case was brought, whether their mistake on an OCI certification needed to be reported under a mandatory disclosure rule, who knows where you'd come out on that.
Right.
Now it's a little bit easier because there's the DC Circuit has said that this could be the basis for a False Claims Act case. But as I said, there's a lot more clauses in there that a contractor may be not complying with inadvertently, what DOJ might say is recklessly. And when you find out they're not complying, does that now cause it to be a False Claims Act violation? And courts have commented that not all contract non-compliance or even...
Well, you know, Jack, off the whole, you know, I'm not in compliance with my break right now. So,
oh, okay.
So I do have to take a break. But we're talking to Jason Workmaster and Jack Horan, partners at McKenna Long and Aldridge LLP here in Washington, D.C. This is Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
What do successful small, medium, and large federal contractors, including two-thirds of the top 100, have in common? Membership in the Coalition for Government Procurement. Successful federal contractors know they get the information edge they need on developing acquisition trends and an effective voice to protect their interests from coalition membership. For nearly 30 years, the coalition's been the trusted voice of industry, working with federal officials to promote common sense procurement. Know what the best know. Join the coalition today to protect and grow your company's business. Contact the Coalition at 202-331-0975 or visit their website at thecgp.org. That's 202-331-0975 or thecgp.org. Don't be left wondering what will happen to your federal business. Contact the Coalition today.
David Aguilar, Deputy Commissioner from U.S. Customs and Border Protection, commented during the panel discussion, Global Illicit Supply Chains, Protecting Citizens and International Borders.
This country imports over $2 trillion worth of merchandise on a yearly basis. We export over $1.8 million worth of merchandise. Embedded within those legal supply chains is where the illicit supply chains try to basically hide.
To hear this show in its entirety, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Booz Allen.
Criminal organizations develop and utilize increasingly sophisticated supply chains to move contraband across global networks. To help combat the global problem of illicit supply chains, Booz Allen Hamilton's strategy and technology consultants are working closely with U.S. intelligence, law enforcement, and other agencies charged with slowing or preventing illegal trafficking, leveraging holistic and comprehensive supply chain attack strategies to help curb the flow of illegal guns, drugs, finances, cybercrime, and people. Count on Booz Allen to help you be ready for what's next. Learn more at BoozAllen.com/expert voices.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth every Saturday at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Federal News Radio. Join me this week for my special guest, Len Wolf, president of The Wolf Group, an international tax and investment advisory firm located in Fairfax, Virginia. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin, Feldman & Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia. Visit us on the web at www.ofplaw.com.
If you know the symptoms and get the facts, you'll know the signs of a heart attack. Women, listen to me, and when I'm done, if it sounds familiar, call 911.
Pain in the neck, chest,
arms, the jaw,
shortness of breath.
Please tell us more. Cold sweats and nausea, tiredness.
It's time to take it serious.
Back pain, stomach pain, shortness of breath. Cold sweats, nausea, dizziness. If you know the symptoms and heed the signs, you'll be around for a long, long time. Women, listen to me, and when I'm done, if any sound familiar, call 911.
Learn a song that can save your life. Get a free download at womenshealth.gov/heartattack.
Women, listen to me, and when I'm done, if any sound familiar, call 911. If any sound familiar, call 911.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Jason Workmaster and Jack Horan from McKenna Long and Aldridge, LLP. And we're talking about the Civil False Claims Act and what it means to government contractors. And when we took the break, Jack, you were talking about the mandatory disclosure rule and, you know, the difficulty in assessing whether, you know, something, you know, is a, you know, I'll put routine in quotes, contract manner versus something that you might have to report, you know, in accordance with that clause.
That's right. And my point is that the False Claims Act has been extended into areas over the past few years that even experienced practitioners would not have predicted. And when a client comes to you or when a contractor determines that they have a contract noncompliance or even a breach of contract, they have to make a determination as to whether it's something that's reportable under the mandatory disclosure rule. And that's a difficult decision to make at times. As some courts, there's a hopeful line of cases out there where courts have noted that not every contract noncompliance and even beyond that, not every contract breach is a False Claims Act case, but trying to predict in advance which are and which aren't, unless there's some precedent in the area, can be very difficult.
Yeah, and Jason, you know, in terms of a contractor coming forward to disclose something, do you have any words of wisdom or in that regard that you'd like to share?
Well, I would just encourage folks to be very, very careful. And there's been some other developments in this area as well in some False Claims Act litigation involving the GSA schedules, where there was a disclosure made, a voluntary disclosure. This was a disclosure made prior to when the mandatory disclosure rule went into effect. But it was followed up, as is often done in these cases. There's a disclosure made of, hey, we think we might have a problem, and we'll follow it up with a report. And in this instance, that's exactly what the contractor did. They retained an outside law firm. The outside law firm retained outside accounting firms. A very thorough investigation was done, looked at lots and lots of data. A report was ultimately submitted to the government on the letterhead of the outside counsel's outside law firm. And that case ended up in litigation in court, and the relator remains involved in that case, and the relator made the argument to the court. The contractor relied on this report by the outside counsel. They used this as a sword to try to convince the government that nothing was wrong, or that there were minor violations. Therefore, the contractor had waived their attorney-client privilege, which, you know, all contractors are normally very scrupulous to maintain that privilege. They want to protect, you know, be able to talk to their lawyers freely and get free, you know, get unvarnished advice from their lawyers. The relator said because the contractor had relied on this report, submitted this report, that they had waived the privilege with respect to all of their communications with their outside law firm leading up to that report. And the court actually agreed. And so the court has determined that the contractor had waived the privilege, and so the relator and the government are going to get all of the communications, all the email, and I'm sure there's numerous of them, back and forth between the contractor and its outside lawyers, leading up to that report on all matters relating to that contract.
Well, Jack, what are the, you know, sort of, can you just sort of, just, what would the ramifications of that be in terms of access to all this? First, you know, tell us, explain what is the attorney-client privilege and what is, and I think by explaining that you'll be able to go right into, like, what does it mean to a government contractor or just anybody in terms of, you know, waiver and access to those attorney-client communications.
Sure. The attorney-client privilege is, I think probably most of the listeners have heard about in some form or fashion, has been around for, I guess, as long as attorneys have been around. And it's designed to protect the confidentiality of the communications between an attorney and his or her client, with the thought that an attorney cannot provide valuable legal advice unless the client believes they can talk to the attorney very openly and have those conversations or communications protected. In today's world, with corporations as attorneys, as clients, some would say it's become even more important because you have this entire organization made up of many, many people who communicate among themselves and to the attorney, and the attorney is faced with obtaining information from that living entity. The attorney-client privilege, if it's not waived, protects the communications between the individuals in the corporation and the attorney providing advice. And it is candid advice, and it's candid communications. Good attorneys will, you know, talk to their clients and say, tell me the worst because I want to understand it. I want to be able to provide you with counseling on what to do about your issue. So in the case that just Jason talked about, the conclusion by a court that the attorney-client privilege has been waived basically frees up all of those communications to be turned over either first to the court for review, but ultimately to the other side, so that the other side has the communications that the client thought were confidential between he or she and the attorney at their disposal. And any attorney in litigation would love to have those communications because they're usually the, you know, the worst of the facts for the client.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that would provide probably would provide a roadmap, you know, for, you know, the opposing counsel, roadmap for attack in terms of, you know, litigating the matter. Mm-hmm. Is this something that, you know, is this a one-time deal, or, you know, is there presidential value to this? Presidential value. Excuse me. I misspoke.
I think each of these cases will largely be determined on their facts, so it's unclear exactly what presidential value this will have. This is just an order in this case.
You pronounced it much better than I did.
There's a particular order in these, you know, in this particular fact situation. But I do think it will mean for those of us who practice in this area, just, you know, giving even more consideration to these issues as we counsel clients, because, you know, especially with the mandatory disclosure rule, when you're making a disclosure and you're going to say, well, we went out and we got the outside law firm and this is what they looked at and here's the conclusions, you know, I think it will cause folks to think twice about, you know, how they proceed, how they handle privilege issues in that context. You know, another issue that's percolating in that case is that the relator has asserted that, well, you know, there was obviously violations here, and obviously from the privilege logs we've seen, the lawyers were in on it. And the court has said, all right, well, I'll take a look at all of the communications for that reason, because, of course, and there's an exemption to the attorney-client privilege. We attorneys can't help our clients commit fraud on a prospective basis. We can't help our clients commit crimes on a prospective basis. And so the relator has said, well, court, you got to look at this stuff and see if the relators were helping the contractor out here.
The attorneys were helping the
contractor out on committing fraud, and that still has that issue is still hanging fire in that case.
Let's from a government contractor's perspective, are there things that they would find in terms of recent developments that are, you know, more positive from a contractor's perspective than what you've described? With regard to the attorney-client privilege,
pretty bleak so far.
They're fewer and far between. You know, I can say that
not as many, but there are a few. And back to the D.C. Circuit case we talked about a little bit ago.
You mean the organizational conflict?
The OCI case with the implied certification. Even though that particular part of the case was not helpful for contractors, the court also said the Justice Department had relied on what's known as a collective knowledge theory to establish that the contractor had the requisite intent. And the collective knowledge theory is, okay, we're going to take all the employees that the contractor has.
Somebody had to know.
No, it's not that somebody had to know. It's that everybody, if you take everybody, 20,000 people or however many people are employees of this company, you pull all their knowledge together. And if you can say, this guy over here knew there was an OCI clause, this guy over here knew about this business interest, this guy over here knew about the other one, you pull it all together and voila, they knew.
Collective knowledge.
You've got collective knowledge. And the court did say they rejected that. So that's good news for contractors. The court said, we reject the collective knowledge theory. The government and or a relator is going to have to show a person, an individual, had the requisite knowledge. That's helpful. That's better than we can just kind of pool everything together.
And that is very good news from my perspective, because what's troubling about the collective knowledge doctrine is not only that you can look to any individual within the corporate entity for knowledge, but no one, no single individual has to even understand that a wrong has occurred, that fraud has occurred. So, you know, in a pricing example, a classic fraud case, if person who's filling out, and let me use your price reduction clause case, if the person who's billing the government has no idea that there's been a commercial sale that should cause a additional reduction to the government, but someone else in the other coast of the company knows about that commercial sale, but has no idea that there's even a GSA contract in place and what implications that sale has to the GSA contract, that collective knowledge can be used as a False Claims Act case, which is always troubling. So the fact that the court is at least taking a hard look at that in the D.C. Circuit, it's very helpful to contractors.
Yeah. Okay, guys. And right now, we do have to take a break. This is Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and we're talking to Jason Workmaster and Jack Horan from McKenna Long and Aldridge, and we're talking Civil False Claims Act and what it means for a government contract.
Almost 70 years ago, a well-known Connecticut native named Homer Cummings had a dream to start a Washington law firm devoted to working at the intersection of America's business and government. As Attorney General for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he was an integral part of the New Deal. In 1956, Gilbert A. Cuneo joined Cummings' firm to begin what was quickly to become the largest and most successful government contract practice in the country, earning him the title, the Godfather of Government Contracts. That same firm, McKenna, Long & Aldridge, today is recognized by Chambers USA as a Tier 1 government contract law firm, continuing its preeminence in the field through its offices in Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, Denver, and San Diego. With the oldest and largest government contracts practice in the United States, McKenna, Long & Aldridge still operates at the intersection of business and government. They produce solutions by working with their clients on creative and flexible strategies that ensure success. Their attorneys and professionals include former members of government, Congress, and its committees, so they know how Congress thinks and they understand how Washington works. There is no aspect of government contracts with which they are not familiar. In this uncertain economic climate, clients trust them to deliver solutions at costs that represent real value. From one new deal to another, they have remained at the forefront of government contracting. McKenna, Long & Aldridge, a name you can trust.
And now, the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
The debate over who gets paid more, the public sector or the private sector, continues. Republican lawmakers complain the federal workforce is overpaid compared with the private sector. But the director of the Office of Personnel Management, John Barry, says many federal workers are actually underpaid, and most comparisons to the private sector just don't hold water. Barry says President Obama has frozen annual pay increases for 2 years. I'm Amy Morris.
Are you getting the most value for your life insurance premium? Probably not. Therefore, take a moment to check out WEPA, a nonprofit association founded in 1943 that enables federal employees to purchase better life insurance at far better prices. WEPA offers premium refunds, a college scholarship program, and most importantly, rates that are much less than the federal program. Visit WAEPA.org to learn more. Once again, that's WAEPA.org.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
The National Archives says its Civil War records are among its most requested, but until now, reviewing those documents required a trip to Washington and time reviewing the original papers. But the Archives has now put about 275,000 pages of records with the names of some 3 million potential draftees online. To get the job done, the Archives partnered with the genealogy service Ancestry.com. After 5 years, the Archives will own the digital records free and clear.
General Dynamics Information Technology is dedicated to providing the latest, highest quality information technology services and resources to help organizations meet their mission objectives. Large-scale IT systems and communications networks are the strategic and operational heart of defense, intelligence, civilian government, and private business. They require the expertise of a company that delivers results. General Dynamics Information Technology and professional services. Go to GDIT.com to learn more. That's GDIT.com.
Plan now to attend a firm's April 14th special half-day in-depth look at mobility. You'll hear from a dozen speakers on how government can effectively build and innovate using an enterprise mobility ecosystem. You'll gain a broad perspective from a variety of agencies, including State Department, Energy, GSA, Army, and Customs and Border Protection. That's Thursday, April 4th at the George Washington University Marvin Center in Washington, D.C. Register today at www.affirm.org.
Connect with Federal News Radio wherever you are. Like us on Facebook to see the hottest news stories on your wall. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FedNewsRadio. Download our free iPhone app. Just go to the App Store and search for Federal News Radio. And now, connect to the radio station straight from your cell phone. Just call 712-432-6616. Go to federalnewsradio.com and search for social media for details.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today we're talking to Jason Workmaster and Jack Horan from McKenna, Long & Aldridge, LLP. And we've been talking Civil False Claims Act and what it means for government contractors. And I guess, you know, what we haven't really talked about is what can government contractors do in terms of compliance? You know, what investments, what things should they do? You know, if they're going to, you know, be submitting invoices to the federal government under their government contracts. Jason?
I guess my the number one piece of advice I would give is think about this stuff early and to think about it often. You know, and ideally you're going to be thinking about these issues before you apply for your schedule, before you get that first contract. That's the ideal situation. If you're already in, if you're in that situation, if you're contemplating entering the government market, you know, be aware of these things and just recognize what you're getting yourself into. I think that's number one. And then if you're, you know, in the GSA schedule context, if you're applying for a schedule, you know, or any contract, you know, be very diligent as you're making any statement to the government. You know, keep that in the back of your mind. As you just said, Roger, I am making a statement to the United States government. That is a different thing than even making a statement to Microsoft. That's a different kind of thing. Just keep in the back of your mind who your contracting partner is. And just, you know, if you come across information, because, you know, in the context of having to make a disclosure, you know, to get a contract or, you know, some kind of compliance issue during performance, you know, if you're not going to disclose something, you know, consult experts, consult your attorneys. And it's almost gotten to the point where I'd almost recommend, I'd be curious to hear what Jack would say, I'd almost recommend tell the government what you're not disclosing. If you're not going to disclose something, tell the government you're not doing it.
You know, just to be clear, you're putting also in the context of the mandatory disclosure rule, which is a requirement. So you're talking about you've got to disclose. But you're sort of saying also say why you're not disclosing.
Say yes. I mean, for example, in the CSP, your commercial sales practices form, when you're submitting to get a GSA schedule contract that asks for all your commercial sales history, you know, and there's some database out there that you said, you know, that database isn't relevant. I'm not even going to go look in that database. Tell the government you're not going to look in that database and document it up front. Because if you just don't look at it and you decide it's not relevant and then you don't say anything about it, you can be second guessed.
The government could argue, I relied that you looked at everything.
Exactly. That's exactly what's happening.
So I negotiated a price that, you know, I may have gotten a better price.
That's exactly right.
Fully disclosed.
And for GSA contractors in particular, I find that they oftentimes get tripped up by the government contract rules because they're companies that rely primarily on commercial sales and are using the GSA contract as their introduction into the government marketplace. So it's important for them for their GSA contract specifically to have a compliance program and not rely on their general ethics program that they use for conducting business commercially. And I would go a step further and say have at least one individual in the organization who is in charge of GSA contract management who fully understands and has some experience in government contract rules, because they are counterintuitive and contrary to the commercial rules. It's the only area where before you negotiate with the other party, you provide them all the information you can think about on your commercial sales practices and the prices you give.
Right, because you're in a certain sense negotiating against yourself.
Yes,
right?
You are. And I can't tell you, Roger, how many times clients have said, well, it can't mean that. Why would I tell them that? And it means exactly that. Tell them everything you can think of and everything that you would not want to tell typically someone you're negotiating with. And then I guess my other bit of advice is, despite everything I've kind of whined about how difficult it is to identify what could be a False Claims Act violation, there are areas where we know the government is interested. And Jason named one of the key areas, and that's the commercial sales practices clause, a disclosure requirement. So you need to pay particular attention for a commercial sales practices disclosure. I mean, I've done them with clients, and they don't take a day, they don't take a week. For a complex organization, they could take many weeks to get them right. The other areas are the price reduction clauses you mentioned, the Trade Agreements Act, and now OCI, and we're all waiting for the next one. And pay particular attention anytime you make a representation to a contracting officer or an auditor, because mm-hmm. they're going to be claiming they relied on those representations, regardless of how unimportant or immaterial you think they may be.
And when you're dealing with, you know, like the production of data, of sales data up front, you know, that's going to, because, you know, Jack was mentioning, you know, the importance of having a single contracts administrator, you know, who's in charge of doing this stuff and doing it right. You know, that contracts administrator is oftentimes relying, you know, on IT people. You know, the people right. who, I mean, that contracts person might not know what data is in the databases. And so, you know, it's really a matter of educating not just that person, but that person being empowered to educate other people as to the significance of, you know, if the IT person who may not really have a good understanding of why the contracts administrator is asking for sales data, you know, down the road, you know, the worst thing that could happen is, you know, that, well, you know, the IT person had a lot to do that day, so they just gave them the data they thought would suffice, and the contracts administrator thought, oh, he gave me all the data. And, you know, there's a disconnect there, and nobody meant to do anything wrong at all. And then 6 years later, both of those people have, you know, gone on and done great things, gone to other places of employment, and there's no record of any of that. And the government comes in and says, oh, my goodness, if I had only known that existed, oh, you know, my prices would have been cut in half. So, you know, that's the and it's, you know, what, can you cover that contingency all the time? No. But the more that you have a culture that, you know, within the company that understands, look, we're a company that does business with the United States government. That's a different kind of thing than doing business with anybody else.
And that's where specific compliance programs are helpful. If you have sophisticated GSA contractors have standard operating procedures that tell the individual what they're supposed to look for, how they're supposed to record it, how they're supposed to memorialize it, and how they're supposed to disclose it, so that if they do leave 5 years later or 6 years later, the company can at least rely on that procedure and say, well, we can't tell you what was in that person's mind, but here's the procedure.
Here's the rules, and here's a record of what happened that time. Well, you know, it sounds to me, well, you know, it sort of hits on some themes. It's preparation, you know, the first, number one, understanding the requirements, I think, obviously, right, especially in the pricing area. Preparation, being thorough, and understanding your business. It's almost like you've got to understand yourself and then and your operations, and then take these rules and apply it to your operations so that you can the output is, here's, you know, a fully disclosed, appropriately disclosed, you know, set of, you know, pricing information in the schedules context.
And what I think gets, you know, it's interesting, you know, there's been a number of these GSA cases over the course of the last several years, GSA is looking for one thing. They're looking for numbers. They want to see what you told them in numerical terms. And so when you are submitting those disclosures, just be very careful with how you're describing those numbers. And because I think where sometimes folks have ended up getting tripped up is they say, look, we told you X, Y, Z about our sales practices, and we told you it in words. And I would agree with them. I would agree with them. No fraud there. We told you in words. But it doesn't get them off the hook, because there's, at least not as far as DOJ is concerned. And these cases almost always end up settling, so we don't have reported decisions. So we don't know how a court would ultimately resolve these questions. But when the contractor's saying, hey, I told you this in words, and the GSA people are so, but here's what you told us about your numbers, and then we just don't see it. And that's where I think contractors just, maybe some of the lesson of this lies, is just be focused on what you're making, focus on what you're disclosing in those numerical terms about your pricing and your discounts.
All right, well, do you have any, you know, just what do you think, we only have a couple minutes left. What's the biggest mistake, do you think, contractors make when they're, you know, dealing in this area, or is there one?
in my experience, it's contractors thinking that the disclosures don't mean what they say, which is essentially tell us everything about your commercial sales practices, and in the context of the price reduction clause, tell us every time that a triggering event has occurred, and for the TAA, tell us the country of origin for each of the products that you offer to the government. Right. And government does mean that. And what seems like a reasonable practice at the time of the submission to the government can sometimes look unreasonable when it's being reviewed by lawyers years later.
Well, it sort of, that reminds me of that mantra that you'd heard, disclose, 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 right? Yeah.
No, that's exactly right.
That's right.
So, well, we are now, I have to disclose, we're out of time. But I want to thank Jason Workmaster and Jack Horan for talking today about the Civil False Claims Act and what it means to government contractors. This is Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition of Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.